Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Spiritual Hollywood Hour. I am Kate Romero, your host of Spiritual Hollywood. And as usual, like I do every week and every chance I get, I'm going to say thank you to Don Newsom, Douglas Newsom, and Seth Hendrick at VBS Radio for providing us this great platform to raise consciousness using positive media. And everything about VBS is geared towards helping people understand their greatness. And that's an amazing thing, and it's a great time to be alive. Speaking of a great time to be alive, I have as my guest this evening Mick Quinn, who has a new book out called The Uncommon Path. His website is very easy. It's www.mickquinn.com, mickquinn.com. And if you go to the website, you'll see a fantastic photo of a radiant being staring you in the face. That's just a small sample of what you're going to get tonight is the light within this human being and his wife, Deborah. What a dynamic duo. Mick is the founder of Choice for Enlightenment Living Fellowship, and he currently resides in Utah with his wife, Deborah Prieto. And this Irish-born author was the founder and CEO of several multi-million dollar companies and is quoted regularly in many publications, including CNN Living, The Washington Times, and The Wall Street Journal. He chose to give up this American dream lifestyle in 2001 and studied Buddhism, Christianity, and the evolution of consciousness, all in search of discovering and expressing his eternal motives. The Uncommon Path is a second book by Irish author Mick Quinn, and Mick's work has been published in Spanish as Poder y Gracia by Corona Borealis, I hope I'm not slaughtering these words, publishing in the summer of 2007. And Mick's life was radically transformed in the summer of 2001 while sitting in meditation with spiritual teacher Andrew Cohen. As a result of this inner transformation, Mick left his former life behind and began to write and teach about the seed of greatness that lives in each and every one of us. So without further ado, I'm going to let Mick come on and tell you the rest about himself, because I could just go on and on myself, but then I wouldn't be having Mick be my guest. I would be my own guest as Mick, okay?
Hi, Kate.
Hi, that was existential. So www.mickquinn.com, please pull up the website and see this lovely person I'm talking to. And Mick, thank you for joining us this evening. I've been very excited about this conversation and this interview to just expose you to the Spiritual Hollywood listeners in a way that will inspire them to take a look at your book and rediscover themselves or maybe meet themselves for the first time through your personal journey.
Thank you, Katie.
Wherever you would like to start, I am excited to go there with you. And if there's anything I left out of the bio that's really important in your mind for our listeners to know right up front, then please share that.
Well, you know, I think you did a wonderful job. Thank you very, very much. And also, it's my pleasure to be on air with you. I'm not sure that you didn't leave really too much out there. I think you did a very good job. So maybe you can just do the interview without me. You just call the voice of Mick Quinn and just continue on.
I haven't got that lovely Irish accent that you still carry a slight little bit of. But
there you go. It's still there.
I like it. It's really appealing and endearing and very approachable. So I'll give the listeners call-in numbers should anyone wish to call in. Toll-free is 888-815-9756, and that's worldwide. And line 1 is 530-327-7602. Line 2 is 530-776-5185. Line 3 is 530-413-4511. And again, the toll-free worldwide number is 888-815-9756. So tell us a little bit about Choice for Enlightenment Living Fellowship.
Well, Katie, this is an organization that basically, number one, it funds this work because, as you mentioned there, I was in business for many years, and I got out of that right before 9/11, and started to look at the other options in life, and that is the organization that funds this work, and it also organizes the people who are involved in this work as far as volunteering and marketing and trying to get the word out there. So that's our umbrella group.
Okay. And The Uncommon Path is quite a book. You can open it anywhere and get an answer. You can read the whole thing, too, page by page. And if you're the kind of person who's in a hurry all the time and got lots to do, and you just have a question in your mind or a thought in your head, just open up your book and you'll get an answer to whatever it is. It's just wonderful how your book works that way.
Thank you.
So I want to talk to you tonight about concealed conditioning. That is such an amazing topic, and so many people don't realize that they don't realize that they live that way.
I think this is one of the central topics in the book, Katie, and we can try and do justice to this in the short time that we have here, but this is something that kind of struck me like a ton of bricks, literally, when I discovered how we are really informed by our culture as far as what is supposed to make us happy, what's supposed to fulfill us. And when we begin to awaken to that level of conditioning, we actually realize how deep it goes and how in many, many cases it actually informs almost every single aspect of our lives. And part of the awakening process is just coming to terms with this and then actually deciding to do something about this. And in the book, I call it concealed conditioning, and I for a very specific reason, because it's literally hidden away from us. It literally is. And I mean, if you go back to the beginning of the development of the self, and even the ego that many spiritual teachers and many spiritual teachings are pointing us towards in identifying and transcending and letting go of, and even in some cases killing the ego, a lot of these teachings are actually wrapped up in concealed conditioning without them even knowing it, because the sense of choice that we're using or the process of choice that we're using is actually coming out of concealed conditioning. So in an interesting way, and this is one point I tried to put across in the book, and I go into much more detail about this in the book, is how in many, many cases concealed conditioning is actually driving the process to let go of itself, which, as you can imagine, is kind of like the dog chasing the tail, and all we do is tend to go around in circles a little bit.
Right. Now, with concealed conditioning, Mick, how do you recognize it? And after you recognize it, how do you renounce concealed conditioning? Because that truly would be a life-altering thing to do.
It really would be, and it really is, and as I said, it is one of the major themes that runs through the book. As I said, if we go back to the development of the self, and I look at this from the Ken Wilber, who is with the Integral Institute in Denver, has been writing since the 70s on the development of consciousness, and his research revealed that prior to about 4,500 years ago, we didn't actually have a sense of self. Now, this mightn't make much sense now to us, because we're all so very familiar with me or with I, or with when we look in a mirror, I see myself. And what's interesting is before this sense of self emerged, there were actually very evolved communities. We had role differentiations. We had major empires. But at the level of the individual, there was actually no self. There was no personal property even. Like I wouldn't own the house because there was no I to actually own the property. Even though we had highly evolved civilizations, it's kind of an interesting concept to begin to imagine what it must have been like to try and make a decision when there was no self to make that choice. Now, what happened is around the world simultaneously, and this is according to a general consensus of cultural anthropology, a sense of self emerged at the level of thought, which literally means I can think about myself or I can think about my thoughts. Now, shortly afterwards, now and I'm talking maybe 200 or 300 years after this, there was a mental process evolved whose role it was to defend this sense of individuality. That is the ego. So the ego is not as old as humanity. The ego is only, what, 5,000 years old, maybe 5,500 years old. So it's not that old.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
So think about this. For the history of humanity, at least in the last 5,000 or 6,000 years, we have been developing and honing and paying most of our attention to the sense of individuality, and also to the ego that defends this sense of individuality. And a lot of spiritual teachings have emerged that are based upon identifying this, and we have done a really good job with this. But I think what's happening now is that we're beginning to understand the limitations of individuality. Now, I'm not saying that individuality is wrong. I'm just saying that an excessive focus on it will tend to lead us in circles.
Right.
So what concealed conditioning is based on the decision-making process that was given to us by the ego 5,000 years ago. That, in the book, I call conceptual free will. So it's free will that's based in the concept of individuality and the concept of the ego that is whose role it is to defend this sense of individuality. And then I begin to make a distinction between conceptual free will and conscious free will. So conscious free will is, how do I make choices that are beyond the scope of individuality, beyond the scope of the ego?
Right.
And this is what begins to reveal this concealed conditioning. Now, simple examples. I offer a lot of these in the book. One very simple example of the distinct possibility that there is concealed conditioning present would be, let's say, emotional conflict in a relationship,
right?
Or maybe a personal psychological conflict around a particular issue in your life. Now, these are very simple examples, and as I said, I go into detail. I speak in depth about this in the book. But these are pretty simple examples.
Right. Now, concealed conditioning, when I hear that term, it makes me think of, where am I, where is Kate Romero operating from automatic thinking that was a conditioning from my upbringing and the environment that I was raised in, that does not belong to my authentic self? And where is the concealed conditioning of my mother's perceptions and seeing life through her filters? What part of her filters have I taken on for myself? And if so, if I've done that, what's the best way for our listeners to recognize that in themselves if they've also done that?
Well, you know, in a really big picture, what I like to do is to say there are two reasons why I would pursue a conscious path of self-development or a conscious spiritual path. So there are two big reasons. One would be for my sake.
Yes.
So what I mean by that is, from a subjective perspective, I'm looking to be an individual who is more at peace, more open, more compassionate. I'm looking maybe to develop my meditation practice so that I can be more present. So these might be reasons why I would pursue a path of spiritual development. So primarily, the reason why I develop myself is for the sake of myself and the sake of my subjective experience and the sake of my experience in my own personal relationships. So that's one primary reason. Now, what I try to put across in the book is that there is another reason why we would pursue a path of spiritual development, and that would be...
Yes, very important.
Okay. That would be for the sake of humanity.
Absolutely.
So I develop myself for the sake of humanity, which means that I actually care more about the spiritual development of a person that I'm in a relationship with than I do about the personal circumstances of that relationship. So this really switches the tables, because the ego is a really amazing structure, right? When a dog looks in a mirror, it doesn't see itself; it just sees another dog. So a dog definitely has Buddha nature, but it can't actually be aware of it. A dog can't sit down and meditate and experience expanded states of consciousness because there's no self there to do that. So the sense of individuality was an amazing emergence in humanity. What we need to do now is we need to have the ego begin to work for us, as opposed to us being just working for it, because we have been so integrated with that structure in consciousness since, let's say, 4500 BC.
Yes. Well, it's quite a task to get everybody to start looking at it that way, and I believe one person can ignite consciousness globally. And I believe that the concept of looking at concealed conditioning can be a catalyst to get people to start looking at what part of their ego is running their life and how to turn that around and be in charge of their ego. You know, you just see on the freeway people cutting each other off in the road rage that, you know, egos are running many people's lives. You know, it's evident everywhere.
It's even evident on a global basis. I mean, if you can look at the different levels of development of different cultures, what you're looking at is the different levels of development that the ego is at. And interestingly enough, here in the United States, this is actually the most evolved country in the world. I spent 5 years living in Europe and with my wife and teaching there. And it's amazing the number of people in this country who are so aware of this and beginning to wake up to the potential of what I call in the book our awakened relationships. Now, these are relationships that are beyond the basis of individuality. They're relationships for the sake of the whole. So I come together with another person or with two other people or with 500 other people for the sake of humanity. So the goal or the product or the creation of our relationship is more important than the actual personal requirements in the relationship. So the uncommon path points to a whole new way of being, at least the potential of it, at least what I've become aware of in my own path and in my own work and in the way I try to integrate Wilbur's work with Cohen's Evolution and Enlightenment and Genpo Roshi's Big Mind, and to put those together with some practical exercises. What I'm doing is just presenting possibilities, and I can summarize it and say that individual transformation is a prerequisite to world peace, and that begins in your own living room. So what we're trying to do is bring the mystic off the mountain into the living room, at the kitchen table, in the relationship with your husband, with your wife, with your girlfriend, with your son, with your boss. That's the relationship that needs to awaken. The ego will take the problems of the world and project them out and say, well, the problem is the Middle East, or the problem is the economy, or the problem is the administration. And yes, there may be certain aspects of the problems associated there, but if you really look at it, the issue is going to begin right in your own home with your practice, with your dedication to transforming yourself for the sake of humanity.
That is absolutely true, and it's like that's such a common sense way to look at it, but common sense is not so common. So the uncommon path can awaken your common sense if you just open the book and read it.
That's why it's called the uncommon path, right?
Exactly. I know that Gary Renard really likes your book too, and loves your philosophy and the journey that you've been on. And he's also a friend of ours, and he's a big friend of BBS Radio. Everybody loves Gary Renard also. And what I'm wondering is, I noticed too in your book that you bring up the metaphysical distractions.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit for our listeners? What is a metaphysical distraction? I have an idea, and I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of individuality and ego again. I know I kind of keep harping on this, but this is it's a really interesting perspective to take on. The ego realized that it was terminal, because
uh-huh.
because when the sense of self emerged, it actually became aware of physical death.
Mm-hmm.
So the ego, and you know, there was a the tradition of burying people in the ground actually emerged from right after the ego emerged, because it wanted to deny death.
Ah.
Because the self now was aware that it was terminal, and the ego realized that its time was terminal. That it was, there was no way it was going to last forever, because the physical body, which was technically its caretaker and its host, had a limited time on the earth. So what it did, and this is over the course of 5,000 years, was invent all sorts of ways for us to distract ourselves from the mere fact of our limitation, which is time and being terminal. And all of these processes, you know, the promise of the next life, or a better life, or another life, right? Anything but now. Anything but taking responsibility for the fact that you're alive now. So one of the ideas that I'm trying to put across in the book, by the combination of these different teachings, is let's stand back and take a really big picture. And the really big picture is the energy and intelligence that created the universe is now waking up inside your subjective experience and inside my subjective experience, and we're looking at the world and saying, what a beautiful thing we have created, but also we have a significant number of problems that we need to deal with. Now, when the ego is in the way, what the ego feeds on, and this is something you go back to Eckhart Tolle and the Power of Now, he calls it the pain body. It feeds on emotional and psychological conflict.
Right,
as long as there's emotional and psychological conflict present in your relationships, in your primary, what I call in the book, your relevant relationships, because they're relevant to your awakening, they're relevant to your discovery and expression of your full potential for the sake of humanity. As long as there's conflict there, the ego's in charge.
Right, and we have a caller waiting on the line.
Oh, good.
You want to bookmark what you just said? We'll come back to that.
Absolutely.
Who is on the line waiting to speak? Hello?
Hello, Kate.
Yes.
And Mick.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is James Arthur Mitchell, and I am an aspiring actor and singer.
Uh-huh.
And I live in Buffalo, New York right now. And I can really relate to what you're saying, Mick. I've been on a spiritual path for a long time, and I'm right with you. And I wasn't familiar with you before this program, but I will definitely go to your website and check out your books and everything, because I really feel it. You know, you know what you're talking about, and I think you can help a lot of people. But I did want to say, introduce myself to Kate Romero. Kate, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. I had emailed you, Kate. I don't know if you got it or not, but I have spent a lot of time in the Los Angeles area, and I just thought it would be nice to meet you at some point in the future,
okay,
perhaps.
I did not get your email,
but,
so you might send that again. And we can take that issue on email rather than the interview. So do you have something else you want to ask Mick or mention to Mick?
No, I just really wanted to say, I wanted to say hello to you and to your guest. That was basically it, just introduce myself. I really didn't have any questions, so.
Well, there's there's a really wonderful thing in the book for actors that can be very helpful for actors. It's helpful for everybody. And for actors, I've flagged the page, and it is Evolutionary Pointer. When concealed conditioning is stimulating your creativity with its wants and needs, you will repeatedly question your reason to be. So what I find a lot with actors is when they start experiencing success, they start questioning their reason to be. And Mick, what would you say about that? And thanks for calling, James, and I'll look for your email when you send it. We'll just continue our interview. So if you keep listening, James, you'll hear Mick's response to what I just said.
Thanks, James. And that's actually a great point that you know, at least the coincidence of James being being an actor and a singer. And the ego, depending at the level of development, and at that level, it would be into personal achievement. And we can go all the way to the top in personal achievement. This is one reason why I stopped doing what I was doing after the experience I had and began to write this book, is that you can have absolutely everything materially in the world, success, and even this wonderful creative talent, being a singer-songwriter or being an actor, and still at the bottom of it all, there's a big question. Now, the big question is, based on the fact that you and I and everybody in this planet, every sentient being intuits their sense of oneness. Okay, and we can experience this sometimes spontaneously if we're watching a sunset, or maybe if at the birth of our first child or some monumental event, there is this sense of being absolutely okay or complete with that particular moment. Now, we all intuit this because there is an aspect of ourselves that is timeless, that is eternal. There's an aspect of us that has never been born, and an aspect of us that will never die. This is something that we discover in meditation or in other processes like Big Mind Process or in Andrew Cohen's evolutionary teachings of evolutionary enlightenment. He calls it the authentic self, which emerges in relationships. So there are ways to experience this, but we all intuit this. But what the ego has us do is pursue this sense of completion, but in the external world. You know, we're sending rockets to the moon rather than investigating the power of meditation. We are chasing down the next number one rather than sitting on the cushion for an hour. So this is what the ego is all about, activity. It's all about doing and doing and doing and being busy and being busy and being busy. And next thing you know, as you said earlier, oops, I'm dead.
Yes, I really, what a great segue to oops, I'm dead.
I did that on purpose.
I thank you for that, Mick, because I'm fascinated by that. And you actually quoted Lama Ole Nidhal himself. How do you say that name?
Lama Ole Nidhal.
Okay. I don't know. Let's see. It's quite a bit to read. And
I can summarize it for you. But you know, Lama Ole is he's probably actually quite well known to a lot of your listeners. He's a Western Buddhist teacher, and he's founded at least 550, if not probably 600, Diamond Way meditation centers. And he represents one of the major lines of Buddhist teachings in the world. A fascinating character. I think he's in his 80s. He's still skydiving. He teaches, I think, 300 nights of the year. He doesn't really have a home. Isn't that interesting? He just travels and works off his laptop. But he has summarized the post-death process based on, you know, the research of the Tibetan yoga and the Tibetan doctrines and I guess his own practice. And he actually even teaches a course called POA, which is a Buddhist teaching on conscious death. But what's interesting about this, Kate, and, you know, without reading, I summarize this in the book with, I quote him in the book with his permission, and he speaks about the post-death process. But you know what I find fascinating about this, and this is something I discovered after I had written this section, is that when we go to sleep at night, we actually go through the same process as dying.
Right.
Isn't that fascinating? So we actually don't need to waste a whole lifetime. Now, depending on what a lifetime is, you know, it could be 120 years if you're a lady living in central Tibet, or it could be 5 minutes if you're a child who dies in childbirth. So, you know, how long a lifetime is also quite debatable. But we actually don't need to wait until we die to experience the death and dying process. And this points to something else that I actually don't speak about in the book because I just didn't have room for it, which is lucid dreaming and the beautiful opportunity that's afforded to us every night when we fall asleep, which is exactly the same process as dying, except we're not conscious of it. That that period, you know, that period of the night where you're not dreaming, there's just blank space,
mm-hmm.
right? That's
yeah.
that's this.
Oh,
we're not aware of it.
yep, and I was sharing with you before that I was actually pronounced dead on the scene for 12 minutes when
you mentioned that. Yes.
Yeah, and what I went through, the stages I went through of that process were very much like what I read on page 129 in your book.
Yes.
129, 130. As I was reading that, my husband pointed it out to me because, you know, he's fascinated by the fact that I've been dead before, and he said, you should read that. And I read that, and tears were running down my face because it got my experience was articulated there.
Yeah.
And what I did after I decided to come back into my body, it was my decision to come back. It was my decision to leave also. I did it all, or I allowed it to happen, and I directed it. At least I think I did. But I told myself to go because I crashed down a mountain and rolled in a van 11 times with no seatbelts.
Wow, with no seatbelts.
Seatbelts hit the canyon floor, and as we were spinning down the cliff, I found myself floating weightless in the middle between the two seats because it was spinning so fast.
Wow.
And then when we hit the floor, boom, I hit my head on something
mm-hmm.
and got a big goose egg, but nothing else was wrong. And
wow.
So I started screaming, you know, because I've seen those, back in high school, they had these documentary film.
Oh, yes, I've seen some of those.
If you get
yeah.
hit, if you have a crash, the car's going to blow up, so get out as quick as you can. So I
yep.
was thinking,
yep.
we have to get out of here, And the person I was with, the van was on its side, and the door was exposed upward. So he stood up, and with the strength of Hercules, slammed his fist into the door, and it went flying off like a Frisbee.
Wow.
I scampered out. I was in shock and crawled up the side of the cliff, which was pretty far, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I just laid down on the side of the road when I saw the van down on the bottom, and I thought, oops, I'm supposed to be dead. So
right.
I crossed my arms over my chest and crossed my feet, and I just laid there and until I stopped my heart and my breath, and next thing I knew, there were loads of people out in their pajamas. It was in Scottsdale, Arizona, watching the paramedics give me cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And I was floating about 20 feet, 25, 30 feet above myself. And I have very long hair, you know, just very long hair. And it was floating out all around me as if I were underwater. And I remember thinking, why is everybody so upset? Why? It was my boyfriend at the time that was in the
mm-hmm.
crash with me. And he
mm-hmm.
was crying and crying, saying, please come back, please come back. And I was thinking where I was, why should I come back? You don't really love me, because we were having a fight. And he just kept crying and crying, saying that I was the best girlfriend ever and that he was the bad person and that if I would only come back, he would be better and all this stuff. And meanwhile, there was a rookie paramedic who was in truck number 33 with a pencil trying to take down my stats, and he was nervous.
Yes.
He dropped his pencil, and it got lodged up under the seat. So he went searching for something else to write with and finally got caught up. And
yes.
then, you know, they just gave up on me and said, you know, called the time of death and put a sheet over
wow.
me and wrapped me up, put me in the back of the truck, and my boyfriend at the time stayed in there with me. And, you know, he was crying and saying all these things while laying over my body. And I went, okay, I'm going to come back and test what he's saying. and when I came back...
Wow. Wow.
And when you die, at least this is my experience, when I died, I became one with all that is. I became one with the universe. My spirit, my soul left my body and became one with everything. So to get the universe back into this body was the most painful thing I've ever experienced.
Wow.
When I slammed back into my body, I yelled, oh, my head hurts.
My head hurts, yes. I have a bruise.
Yeah, and my boyfriend at the time just started screaming and pounding on the window for the paramedics to pull over, said, she's alive, she's alive, she's alive. And they
wow.
came back, and they were scratching their head, and it's like, well, she is alive. And they kept me in the hospital for 3 days to observe me to find out, number one, why I died, number two, why I came back. And I told them that it was my choice. And then my boyfriend was on his best behavior and took me to the fire station, and we sought out the captain, and the rookie who had lost his pencil was there, and truck 33 was still there. And I said, "You lost your pencil, didn't you, while you were writing things down?"
Wow.
And his face turned white, and he said, "Yes."
Wow.
And I said, "Come with me. Where's truck 33? And he took me out there with the captain.
Yes.
And I reached underneath the seat and pulled the pencil out without even searching for it. I knew right where it was and handed it to him. And his jaw fell open, and the captain of the fire department started laughing. He said, "You would be surprised to know how many people who had near-death experiences come back and tell us, you know, where we put things or what
mm-hmm.
happened." And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, they just know. And,
right.
And I knew. So the what I got from that experience was we aren't born and we don't die, and we are borrowing this physical body as a host to carry around our spirit. And, you know, after that happened to me, I still sweat the small stuff sometimes, but not nearly as much as I did.
Right.
And I really got clear on just how much power we each have.
Right.
And the great that lives within each one of us. And that if I could do that, then I could do anything. And, you know, I've got at least six streams of
streams
of income that I created myself that are all being of service to humanity to the best of my ability, and I'm just getting started. You know, I'm writing books, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, but that changed my life profoundly to, oops, I must be dead.
And you know, I can take that back full circle now. So let's say that you realized in that experience that you were one with everything, one with emptiness, one with fullness, just one with everything. There was no difference between who you are and what is, or what is even as potential. Now, let's say that when individuality emerged, that particular awareness became aware of individuality and the ego that protects it, and that for the last 5,000 years, that's pretty much what it has been focused on. And now it's waking up to itself. So consciousness is waking up to its own potential and saying, "Oh, I've been fixated on that for 5,000 years. Well, that's great. Okay, we've done wonderful things in the world, right? There's advances in medicine, in economics, in the ability to feed the poor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't need this level of attachment anymore, or
no.
I don't need this level of attachment anymore."
Exactly, and I noticed that for myself anyway. When I'm feeling bad or negative or out of it, it's because I've attached an outcome to something and I'm trying to control something and getting in the way of the universe. When actually, if I just step out of my own way and let the universe do its thing, you know, just be in action towards my goals and desires and then let it go and be hootless about how it shows up, then I'm not getting in the way, and it shows up so much more consistently
right.
when I remember to do that.
Right. Did you say hootless?
Yes.
That's a good word. I haven't heard that one before. That's a lovely word. That's a great one, hootless.
Notice
when
you're hootless about things, the things you desire show up because you're sending out these rockets of desire constantly, whether you want them or not. It's whatever your thoughts are and you're focusing
yeah.
on, you're going to get back.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're focused on, you know, your big goals, like for you, I would love to see the Uncommon Path be in every household around the world. And those who can't read, be taught to read, or for those who can't read, have an audio book made in their language or some way, somehow, to get everybody to have the knowledge that you have, through your own journey, put in this book. And you can focus on that goal, and if you're in action for it every day, at least three or four things a day even, then it's going to happen as long as you're hootless about it.
It's going to happen, and also, you know, Kate, it's also to even hear and be aware of the fact that we meaning humanity, have such a massive potential to create such a beautiful world and such a new world than the one we're already co-creating, that just to be aware of that potential. Like, just to even put that into consciousness and say, wow, is it even possible? Like, the image I give in the book, and maybe this is reflected by James, who called in, and you see these people who've been on the path for 20, 30, 40 years. Like, the other day I had a call from a lady who said to me, she said, "I found your book. I was just about to give up. And I said, well, what do you mean give up? She said, I've been searching. She got divorced 30 years ago. 30 years ago she got divorced. And since then she's been searching for herself. She said, I'm just about to give up. 71 years old. And she said, the book planted this seed of potential I didn't even know existed before.
Right.
This is what I'm talking about. If we can just suggest the possibility that we are timeless beings, and I'm paraphrasing you here, but in a limited body. So we're non-dual awareness in the stream of time, and we're flowing back and forth lifetime after lifetime. Let's begin to work from that perspective to co-create a new reality together without conflict.
Absolutely.
Those of us who are willing.
Totally possible, and when we realize who we really are, we won't want to be hurting each other. And, you know, that some might say that that's a Pollyanna statement, and if it is, then I'm happy to be Pollyanna, because
right.
what I believe and conceive, I will receive, and I know that everybody else can too. And if someone's not saying this stuff, then no one's going to hear it. They're just going to have to wait.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're going to have to wait for it to bubble up inside of them, and unless they're meditating or being still and quiet, that's not going to happen.
Right, and we're never hurting each other. We're hurting ourselves.
Well, right? This is true. Every time we say a bad thing about any other person, you know, knowing that we are all one, we are saying it about ourselves.
We're saying about even our the state of our climate or the state of our planet and our resources. That's it's not pointing to something that's outside of us. It's pointing into us, and you know, as I said before, that transformation begins, right? The end of global warming begins at your kitchen table. That's a big responsibility. The ego is never going to accept it, but at least recognize that resistance. At least recognize that resistance, because then what you're doing is, Eckhart Tolle said, the only thing to do to dispel the pain body is to become aware of it. There's actually nothing else to do. Awareness dissolves the resistance. So if you're brave enough and willing enough and compassionate enough and loving enough and open enough just to consciously bring up the resistance, it
mm-hmm.
dissolves.
Right. No, this is very true. I've done a lot of study on Eckhart Tolle's pain body, and I do know, boy, we saw someone with a pain body yesterday morning who was attacking everybody in sight, and because we weren't being a party to it, we were just doing a keto and energetically letting it go off our backs and away from us. She was so threatened by the fact that we weren't agreeing with her ego that she attacked my husband verbally as he was walking out the door.
Wow.
And
wow.
We just laughed because we know about these things. And, you know, the pain body needs to feed on something, and other pain bodies will give it a lot to nourish it. And also,
right.
I believe, too, being in the entertainment industry and a talent manager, as a progressive talent manager with a focus on consciousness, I know that horror movies and violence are appealing to a lot of people, and I do my best to avoid putting my clients in those sort of projects, because I believe that it's pain bodies appealing to pain bodies, and pain bodies fill the theater. And when the pain bodies are all there together watching pain body projects, it's lowering the frequency of the planet, in my opinion. So,
right.
As a talent manager, I'm looking to see, even from that microscopic grain of sand, you know, what can I do to make a difference?
Right, right. And you know, speaking of making a difference in my own work, I mean, I also do integral based coaching, which is based on the work of Ken Wilber and his Integral Institute in Denver. And I work with a lot of individuals on the four pillars, and is body, mind, spirit, and shadow, and looking at your life from these perspectives and developing each of these areas separately. And a lot of times I will advise that, like, if you can maybe just take a break from the news, right? We're not denying current events. We're not denying that things are happening in the world, good things and bad things, but just for a while, because it's good sometimes to separate. I mean, isn't that why we go on retreat sometime, is to kind of take a little bit of distance on the busyness of the mind, take a little bit of distance on the things that enthrall us so, and so that we can gain some clarity on who we are, where we're going, why we're going there, and who's in charge.
Well, every time you discover concealed conditioning, it's like discovering a gold nugget in a gold mine.
It is, and then, and here's the other beautiful thing. Right as you discover a point of concealed conditioning, what you are offered is what I call in the book an awakened choice. Now, an awakened choice is your, and I use this word gingerly, your God-given ability to express conscious free will, right? You are consciousness, consciously co-creating the future by taking that awakened choice. Now, here's the awakened choice. It can be very, very simple. Do I want to interact with this or not? Now, this can be any object in awareness. Now, I'm talking a thought, a particular emotion, another individual, a random situation on the street, or something at work. Anything that you recognize from when you study the uncommon path and you begin to become familiar with at least some of these aspects of concealed conditioning, that's an awakened choice. Your future and the future of humanity changes the moment you make that choice, regardless of the outcome, because the reason you're making the choice is because you're choosing to disengage from concealed conditioning. When
right.
you make that choice, that's consciousness itself choosing to express itself through your body in that choice.
Right. And that's the same as saying you're allowing God to express God consciousness through you. And that's what God consciousness is all about, is it's expressing itself through us as long as we don't block it.
As long as we, well, I'm not sure that I would go with the whole with blocking it, but what has happened is that we have accidentally become distracted with the sense of individuality. So we can go all the way to, like, let's say pathological narcissism. We've become distracted with the unhealthy aspects of ego, and we've also become distracted with becoming in the sense of materialistic pursuits. So let's say that God consciousness has spent the last 4,500, 5,000 years doing a really good job in that area. A really good job. We have to compliment it. But I think now is the time to say, you know what? This is not working. It's really not working. Are we any closer after 30, 40, 50 years of quote-unquote self-development? Are we really any closer to being fully self-expressed? Are we really any closer to being able to come together in relationships without conflict? Are we really any closer to being able to look at human consciousness as a ladder of development rather than saying, well, we're all equal and everybody's opinion is the same? Are we any closer to an integral awareness or integral consciousness where we can actually come together and co-create a new future, not only for our own sake, but for the sake of other people on the planet, and also for the sake of the planet itself?
Right, and I noticed that when there's a crisis, people do come together, like you just mentioned.
Well, they do, and then it dissipates. I mean, I saw this after 9/11, Kate, and I was amazed. You know, I had offices at the towers for 7 years, so I was, you know, intimately involved with that whole scenario there. And for about 6 weeks afterwards in New York City, it was one of the most pleasant places to be. People were so open and caring for each other, completely unconditional. 6 weeks later, gone.
Well, that's like the
back to business.
Yeah, that's like the boyfriend who said, I'll do anything if you just come back, and I came back. He became his old self in about 4 weeks.
Right. Now, this is an aspect. I mean, this is not all concealed conditioning. A lot of this would be Freudian and shadow, which is a topic we haven't touched on, which I do go into details in the book, and the necessity of developing this actual aspect of self. But this is what happens, right? We do have great intentions. The problem is that the awareness, our values, which are the structures that guide our decisions, those are all within the control of the unhealthy ego. Chapter 10 or 11 in the book is a values exercise that helps the readers answer the question, what's the most important thing to me? And then to bring up evidence for that in my choices and in what I do with my life and how I relate to other people. And it actually shows you in the book, in great detail, how the ego, since its emergence 5,000 years ago, has commandeered, and I'll use that word, you know, pretty purposefully, our decision-making process. Because think about it this way. If the ego feeds on conflict, then it is going to have to continually recreate conflict.
Yes.
Therefore, our decisions seem to put us in these cycles. Like people say, oh, I can't get away from this, or why does this happen again, or why do I keep attracting this type of person? Well, the reason for that is that inside our value structures, inside our decision-making processes, is concealed conditioning. We have to go in there, take a look at it, and say, ah, there it is. Okay, switch it around a little bit, and bingo. We
right.
begin to remove this unhealthy aspect of individuality from our decision-making process, which produces an entirely different result.
It does, and you're going to have to recast your friends oftentimes because you've chosen a more peaceful way of being, and the people who are counting on you to bring conflict into their lives because they need it too will be going away from you.
This is true. I always say there are two battle fronts on the path of truly awakening to your full potential, and the first battle front is between your own ears. It's the struggle with your own emotional and psychological experience and your perspective that you take on that, and then also the second front or battle front is with the people in your life. And you know, as you said, often people who claim to dearly love you actually are very addicted to conflict.
Right.
So oftentimes we have to make difficult decisions. And in the book, I do offer a suggestion because the ego will say that all of our relationships are relevant to our awakening. And in the book, I say that's not actually true. That's just the ego's opinion. It's actually what I said, and I call it the ego's dharma. Right, not all of our relationships are relevant. Only the ones that we spend a specific amount of time with are relevant. Those are the ones that need the most work. But as you correctly said, sometimes we have to make some tough decisions there because, again, that's an awakened choice. Do I want to continue to feed this conflict, or do I want to step beyond it?
Yeah, and I have a phrase for that. You cannot be lifted if you won't let go.
You cannot be lifted
if you won't let go.
There you go.
So,
beautiful.
I'm going to give your website again. It's www.mickquinn.com, mickquinn.com, and you will find all kinds of interesting information on this site about Mick and where to get his book and coaching and things like that. And tell me about your coaching. We have a few more minutes left in the Spiritual Hollywood Hour, and I'd like you to talk about your coaching and how that's
going. Sure. Well, I started coaching back in the late 90s, and I have since integrated the work of Ken Wilber, the Integral Theory, into the coaching. So Ken has come up with this wonderful theory, the four irreducible aspects of reality. And any problem can be looked at or looked from using these four perspectives. And it's a fascinating coaching process because it involves all the very practical aspects of life coaching, which are post-psychotherapeutic stage of development, with the integral theory, and of course with this non-dual focus of awakening for the sake of humanity, wrapping it all together. And I've seen people make tremendous progress using this process, and I do it mostly by the phone, so it's available. Actually, Kate, I'm offering a free consultation, well, just for an hour, if anyone's interested. There's a link on the homepage, at the top of the homepage. People can email me from there, their information, phone number, and we can schedule a time to speak if anyone's interested, because it's a brand new form of coaching. It just emerged the last 2 or 3 years. Very, very new.
Well, I know, I absolutely am certain that anybody who has a consultation with you will walk away with some really valuable information, and could be life-changing in itself just to have a consultation with you. I can only imagine with the concepts that you're using and applying and looking at a person's life from the four aspects that breakthroughs are popping like popcorn in a hot skillet.
Well, you know, people sometimes ask me to say, how long does it take to wake up? Right? How long does it take me to discover and then begin to express my full potential? And I've actually come up with an answer to that question, and this is based on the clients I've had over the years for integral coaching. And I always tell people, I said it takes 1 year per 10 of life experience on average. So if you were born, like all of us were, into the concept of individuality, into complete immersion in ego, which is totally fine, but it's not good if we want to discover and express our full potential and our purpose in life and come together with other people in relationships beyond conflict. They say, how long does it take? And I say, 1 year per 10. So if you're 30 years old, it's going to take you 3 years. And absolutely everything changes. If you're 50, it's going to take you 5 years. I'm sorry, it takes a little bit longer. If you're 70, it may take 7 years. So you'll do it. But it is possible. That's the message to get across. It is possible to awaken in this lifetime, end karma this lifetime.
That's wonderful. And it doesn't matter what you're doing in that 7 years, because in 7 years, it's still going to be 7 years later. So you might as well be doing something that awakens you.
Right, and also in the coaching process, my wife and I have studied extensively with Genpo Roshi and the Big Mind process, and we have his permission to use the Big Mind process, which combines Jungian theory on shadow and also the essence of Zen teachings, the non-dual aspects of Zen. This Deborah, who you mentioned earlier in the beginning of the call, also works with me in the coaching, and this is a fascinating aspect of the integral coaching, is bringing up shadow and the aspects of ourselves that we have either repressed or denied, knowingly or unknowingly, to integrate that back into the self so we can own those aspects of self. That's part of the coaching.
It takes a huge amount of responsibility and self-awareness and courage to go digging in like that and take that inner journey. And I have a saying that if you don't go within, you're going to go without. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we do on automatic pilot that we don't need to be doing, because every time we do them, we get the same result. And the only way to get a different result is to do a different thing.
It's true.
Picking up the uncommon path will give you a lot of possibilities to consider. So please explore this wonderful book and this wonderful author, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you come up with next, Mick Quinn.
Thanks, Kate.
To birth for our planet and its conscious evolution. I believe that pure expansion is what we're going through right now at this time with economics and the whole thing, and I believe that it's offering everybody an opportunity to go inside themselves and see what part they're bringing to this economical problem. You know, it all starts
right in
our ears. And like you said, you can end global warming at your breakfast table over coffee.
That's where it begins.
Yeah,
that's,
if you're willing to take responsibility for that power that you have. So I want to thank you again for being my guest tonight on Spiritual Hollywood, Mick.
You're most welcome.
Yes, and your website is mickquinn.com. Please check that out. Please check out The Uncommon Path. Thank you, listeners, for being with us this week. We'll catch you next week. And remember, the last six letters of attraction are action. So please start on your own uncommon path. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you.